Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's the Entitled Banter podcast, but it's not Jules Gill, it's Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Hello, actually in person, diving in last minute because Jules has got some bad gas.
Is this a euphemism?
It might be. He might actually have some personal bad gas, but he's definitely got some external bad gas because the man's getting some work done on his house. So Mr. Josh Brown, I called on him. I said, can you fill a slot, please, sir? And you said, I'd love to do that.
Scott, I really do love to do this podcast when Jules is busy with his bad gas. When he's got bad gas specifically. So thank you so much for having me on. And I apologize because this was so last minute. I've not actually woken my mouth up, which sounds weird, but it's all claggy. It's not good. And it's the last time I'll talk about it.
He's a claggy mouth man. But the Entitled Banter podcast is always where we take people's questions, talking points, whatever they've got going on in the gaming industry, and try and get through as many questions as possible. So obvious apologies for people who submitted questions thinking they would be for me and Jules, but it'll all be good anyway. So we'll get through as many as we can. First question from Jack Asbury, who says, when is anime going to get its Batman Arkham Asylum moment? Also, any recommendations for GameCube and Wii games? Metroid Prime was on the list, but not anymore after the Direct. I assume the Arkham Asylum moment is the like holy S, something comes out of nowhere and blows everybody away. And as someone who's been playing a hell of a lot of Demon Slayer, it's not an Arkham Asylum moment, but the Demon Slayer game is infinitely better than I think anyone realizes it is.
This is what I was going to ask you. Yes. Has this not already happened? You know, I'm not in the anime circle as much as you are, but I was looking at the footage that you put up of Demon Slayer the other night. And to me, that looked unreal. Yeah. It looked excellent. It looked like probably what I imagine I would want if I was into Demon Slayer, but has it not reached that same breakthrough bit of quality that Arkham Asylum did for superhero games and specifically Batman games?
I think that's the thing. The Demon Slayer game is animated beautifully. If you get it on PS5 or Series X or whatever, it has that whole 4K 60 thing going on. The scene you're referring to is like when you do, because it's an arena fighter, so like whenever you do like a certain finisher, one of your ultimate arts, the camera just, you know, cuts away. You get these really gorgeous cinematic style finishes which just look unbelievable. If you check my Twitter, I've got the one up there from Uzui from Season 2. And it's just, it's one of those things where like it's just so enjoyable. I've loved that game, and the multiplayer is really fun and everything, and the story is really good. I just feel, well, because it just recreates the show itself, but I feel like the Arkham Asylum moment was like, I don't know, it's like there's a more of a story component to that where it's like genuinely surprising. When I tweeted that thing, that clip from Demon Slayer, I forget who replied saying like, why do we not get more like spin-off titles attached to these franchises? They're always just retelling the same story from the anime. Right. It's like Dragon Ball. Every single Dragon Ball game is just the same story every single time. Something like Kakarot lets you spin off that a little bit, but you're still mostly just following the story. So I wonder if that's what it is, where Arkham Asylum was such a fully formed thing, like on the side. It is Batman, but it's its own story. It's pulling from certain comics, but it is kind of its own thing. Maybe that's what we need.
Well, I mean, it's, like I said, as someone who's not necessarily into specific anime, but really enjoys the anime aesthetic, like when I think about anime and video games, it's stuff not tied to an adaptation. It's stuff like just heavily inspired by it, like Nier Automata or Catherine or whatever it is. Right. You know, it's stuff that's very indebted to the style and very indebted to the tropes and whatnot, but isn't necessarily tied to a specific brand. So my question is there an issue that you couldn't do an Arkham Asylum type game with a specific property because people would be expecting to see those specific characters in a certain way or certain plot points repeated? Like, for as much as you were just talking there about Dragon Ball, you know, just repeating the story of Dragon Ball in every single game, when they didn't do that in Dragon Ball Fighters, It was weird.
That's a good point.
And I, as a casual Dragon Ball fan, didn't like it. And I was just sat there thinking, I kind of just wish this was, the anime brought over to video game form yet again. But that is, you know, annoying. Sometimes.
I know, I forget the Fighter Z, whatever, had a story mode. Like, I forgot about that whole thing with the weird spirit that goes into different characters. And yeah, I forgot about all that stuff. Yeah, I guess that would be something where they did sort of deviate from the source material. But yeah, I mean, for me, like, there are phenomenal anime games, or like you said, anime infused games like Nier or Catherine or Persona, to be honest. Like, I mean, especially the art style in 4 and 5, or 3, 4, and 5, that really start to stand out. So yeah, I just feel like I know what he means, but at the same time, it's hard putting a pin on a specific game as like, this is anime's Arkham Asylum moment, because the overall bar is very high. I will say, though, that right now, like, anime games have gotten so good, like Kakarot or like FighterZ or like Demon Slayer, but the animation is just sky high. Like, that whole Demon Slayer game just recreates the anime and like just makes those scenes 3D, and then you play those fights and whatever, and it just looks like you're playing the show. It's perfect. Like, I absolutely love it. I mean, I'm gorging on Demon Slayer at the minute, looking forward to season 3. So I'll shout that out. Next question from Brandon Bressman, who says, hope that we are doing well. Do we think gaming will ever return to the fun social experience it was with Halo 2 and Call of Duty 4, or are we doomed to forever be stuck in silent lobbies, constantly rushed back to the main menu after a match?
Well, here's the thing, right? And I think I might have mentioned this before, but I'm very nervous. I'm very nervous around people who I don't know.
Okay.
And that translates to online lobbies. So even in the heyday of classic Halo and COD specifically, you know, COD Modern Warfare, COD Modern Warfare 2, when people talk about like these talkative lobbies and stuff, I was always too scared to go in them.
Oh, really? I
was never on mic talking and I would mute everyone. So for me personally, this new era of being able to mute everyone instantly and not have to listen to anyone talk is like my dream come true.
Oh, okay.
And I realize I'm very much an anomaly there because I was just scared of getting bullied.
Well, the thing is, like, there just was so much toxic, absolutely awful stuff said. Like, that's just the reality of people being online yelling at each other when they're full of video game adrenaline or whatever, or just hate in some places. But the thing that I get that Pressman's getting at, which I do remember, especially from Halo 2, was like everyone would talk to each other before the match. Maybe you would just slag off the person on the other team. Oh, you guys suck. F you. And then like after the match, you'd like maybe someone who killed you 5 times over, you'd get like that sort of 2 minutes in the lobby with them where you can be like, hey, Demon Killer 3, you suck. And like, I love that stuff. I love the thing you could do in Splinter Cell Pandora Tomorrow, where if you were playing as a spy and you could get someone in a chokehold and it would open the mic up between you and the player.
Yeah.
So you could grab someone and be like, F you, F you, F you, and then kill them. And then you would go and do something else. And I love that stuff. I love all that taunting and everything. It is just impossible to make it genuinely friendly or done in good spirits or whatever. Like, I was always having fun with it. I always liken game fandoms to sports teams anyway, and rooting for your team or rooting for a dev or whatever. So it's fun like that, same way you might go to like a football match, American football, some sort of sporting event, and cheer for your team and be like, hey, those guys suck, they support those guys. But obviously it tipped over into just full-on horrible stuff, which is why all of that stuff went away.
And I do think that's also that's also led to the rise of, you know, Twitch communities and Discord servers. Yeah. I don't necessarily partake in those communities, again, because I don't want to talk to anyone and I'm scared about what they'll think of me. But I think like those spaces have become not always, but more reliable spaces where you know it's hopefully going to be a more welcoming community. It's going to be a more, progressive space. It's not going to have that toxic element. Hopefully, ideally, much more reliably so than just jumping on, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 and just being, just having like the worst crap imaginable thrown at you when you don't want to hear it. You didn't sign up for that. I think like those other spaces that are there now, you kind of facilitate that kind of community feel in that kind of more friendly atmosphere, hopefully, where you can get those moments where, you know, you're playing a Battlefield game, you're playing a Call of Duty game, and you find random teammates who, make that a memorable experience because you're having fun with strangers, you're getting to know them, you're having a fun time, you don't feel intimidated or you don't feel under pressure or anything like that.
I think, it's like early Xbox Live was like way before forums had admins, when it was just like everyone's just saying whatever and then it's just this weird mess of everything. And then obviously curation comes in over time, which is for the betterment of the vast majority of people playing. I do, like I said, I have like a fondness for those early days of Xbox Live, because for me, like as much as like people would, you know, have a go at each other and whatever, that was drastically overshadowed by the amount of teamwork that happened, where it was just, you were in a team match in Halo 2 on Blood Gulch and everyone would talk to each other. Like, you defend this, you stay here, I'm going to go around the side, you do this. And like, you just dive in there. And if you started talking, people would talk back, and it just worked for a while. There was a real beauty to early Xbox Live, specifically Halo 2 and Splinter Cell Pandora Tomorrow. Those were definitely my first two,
right?
Where people did just talk to each other and it worked. And if someone was being an a-hole, then everyone would just block them or mute them. But it was just that one person. It was only over time when it became like literally everyone sucks, or mute everyone, or someone's playing music in the background or yelling at their mum or whatever it is.
That's it. Like, when I think about those early so-called glory days, yeah, I don't think of anyone kind of like yelling at each other, or even the teamwork. For me, must have been like the lobbies I was in. Maybe they were like European lobbies.
Right.
But from all I can remember of the team chat, it was mostly just people like playing New Monkey Rave down the microphone. And like you said, yelling at their mams when it was tea time. Like, it wasn't even like, didn't even get to the point where they were yelling at each other. It was just like people... It was like being on a bus with someone where they're playing music out their phone, and that was never fun to me.
Oh my God, I'm just thinking everybody around the world trying to please Google New Monkey Rave and be introduced to that style of music that a lot of us had in the UK across the 2000s, or at least we did in the Northeast anyway. But yeah, overall, no, I don't think you'll get a return to the everybody talking to everybody else thing, because the curation just has led to a more pleasant time online, which just is a better way to go overall. Although, maybe there's some way to do some sort of more constructive way to bring people together and give them more team goals or something.
This wasn't the question, man, but I think I'm a freak. I think I'm just like an anomaly in totality, because even when I'm playing like Call of Duty, which I love and play often, or Battlefield or whatever, they're even in the team games, I don't even like talking to my friends. If we're playing Call of Duty together, we might as well be playing different games. And I also don't really like playing split screen either. The only time I like having a team is in something like Warzone, where you really need the teamwork, or Rainbow Six Siege, where you really need the teamwork. Otherwise, it's quite nice to just be in the same game together. But I'm thinking, what am I getting out of this? I'm using real social battery here to talk to you, but we're not actually, it's not needed.
To be fair though, that whole thing of I just want to be part of a group without necessarily being vocal about it is almost like when you're at a house party, there's a house party happening, but you're sort of sitting in the corner a little bit, maybe with a couple of your friends, but not the entire group or something. And you get to have that thing is happening around me energy, which is sometimes quite nice.
I don't smoke, right?
True.
But I love smoke breaks.
And yet he is on fire every now and then.
And I love it because it means when you're at a house party, you can kind of like go outside with someone who is smoking, have a chat with them. And it is comforting just knowing stuff is happening around you. And I do like that.
There needs to be a word for that. I'm definitely calling on people from different countries and stuff, because I know obviously there are specific terms from different countries for certain feelings that we don't really have something in the English language for that feeling. There's got to be a term for that. That almost tranquil nature of like when you're outside a club for a bit and you just go out and you can hear the music, you can hear there's this humanity happening inside, but I'm just taking a minute. I'm just out over here for a bit. There is a nice feeling to that. But anyway, I imagine for online discourse stuff, I've not talked online in forever. Like, I used to just dive in and talk and people would just talk back, but I haven't done that in a long time. Next question from Honest NPC: what are our thoughts on the massacre of live services and how will the industry react going forward? I think one factor is how difficult it is to jump into any game as a newcomer, a problem that I'm facing in Destiny 2. I remember when I went back to Warframe, because I was just like, I heard so much about Warframe over the years, and I played that in 2014 when I first got my PS4, and then it was like 2018 or something. It was one of the, whatever the run-up to their last massive expansion was, and I watched an interview with the devs, and I was like, oh my God, this thing has come on so much. I'll go back on my old account. And obviously that game was overhauled or whatever, but it was one of those things where I fired it up, and I immediately had like 50 pop-ups. I'd missed all these different content drops, all these different alerts, all these different announcements, and I was just buttoning through that stuff for like 10 minutes. And it was that thing of like, I'm so off whatever this treadmill is that obviously most of the players are on. But I definitely agree with that. Sometimes when you go back on some live service game, there are tons of announcements and downtime announcements, whatever it is that they've been telling people, that just clog things up.
I had the same experience with Warframe, like you said there, you know what I mean? I played that when I first got the PlayStation 4, whenever that launched, and then jumped on a few years later when people were telling me how much has changed, how great it is right now. And I'm sure it was, but it was that impenetrability of it that just kind of like put me off. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame because it feels like I have personally missed out on so many great games because of that feeling. Even something like Fallout 76, which I tried to get into now that it is apparently better, I was enjoying from a gameplay perspective, but it was so overwhelming with the stuff that they added that I didn't know the best route through the game. And when you get to the point where you have to get up like a game facts thing or, you know, a wiki page for a game to figure out what's the best thing, what can you ignore in what you want to engage with, that's when it just feels a little bit too like homework. And it, again, it's such a shame, man.
Yeah, it shouldn't feel like an exam that you didn't realize you were supposed to prep for. And it's like, oh, I absolutely hate in any game where I have to like go away from it and go and engage with something else. I'm like, okay, what even, how do I even take the first step towards this? And obviously live service stuff, it's like, here's your dailies, here's your weeklies, here's what you missed, here are the side missions, here's the story content, but you can't unlock that until you've done this. And it's just like, okay, but like, where in here is the meaningful thing? Like, how do I make this actually worth my time? Well, how do I zero in on that? And I feel like a lot of people, I mean, clearly in the amount of live services that are shutting down or have shut down already this year, have similar feelings where it's just like, I just can't latch onto this. It's like this speeding thing that goes past you. But yeah, I don't know what the hell they do for live services. We did some news on it, the amount of different services that have closed down recently. And I just think we had on this DLC, we had microtransactions, loot boxes, battle passes still going fairly strong, but I guess you can't, they need to find a different way of monetizing battle passes without necessarily tying it to the idea of constant engagement through a live service model, but giving you some sort of reward rollout over time. Kind of like what something like Sifu is doing, where it's just like, here are some meaningful new additions and encourage you to come back or whatever. I don't know. They'll need some monetization aspect if we're expecting games to have tails on them, if we're expecting multiplayer components after the shipping window. Although, for me, No Man's Sky has proved that it's doable.
Yeah.
Through sheer unit cost. Although, obviously, I don't know what the hell, how they're balancing the books. But, like, they've kept going for 6-7 years now.
In response to the part of the question that asks, you know, what does the industry do in response to all of these live service games dying? I think the answer is to greenlight more live service games. And it's such a shocking reality, and it's a sad reality. But I just do think that there's a reason why all of these publishers are chasing like the gold standard live service thing. Mm-hmm. And that's because the ceiling on it is so high. The amount of money you can make is ridiculous if you get it right. Granted, very few people get it right. Yeah. You know, there is stuff still going like Warframe, like Warzone, like Fortnite or whatever that managed to nail it. But, you know, for every one of those examples, there's like 100 live service games that dies. But I think publishers are still willing to take the gamble, and we've seen it with Sony buying Bungie and committing to a bunch of live service games, with Ubisoft announcing that all their franchises are going to go to live service. I think all they want is one or two to stick, because if they can sacrifice 5 or 6 to get those one or two games, they know they're set for the next few years. They know they can bring in so much money, and I think that's the reason why they keep going, even though it just means that you have this graveyard of stuff that nobody wanted and resources that could have been better used anyway. That's my very cynical take on it.
Now, see, for me, I feel like, I mean, it depends. It's going to depend on the company how many times they can keep gambling like that. Like, I remember that whole thing about Nintendo have so much worth that they could, like, the Wii U was such a catastrophic failure. Like, it had all these, like, ridiculous sales figures, didn't catch on, whatever. And there was something about the amount of wealth that they've built up over, like, 200 years of business, because they go all the way back to when they used to just sell Hanafuda cards. It was like they could have a Wii U-sized failure every day or something for the next 50 years,
right,
and they'd still be fine. Like, they're completely fine. So they could make those gambles. But looking at Ubisoft and how much they are, like, they appear to come across as struggling, I don't know how many more gambles they can take.
No.
There's also the thing about, like, the amount of time it takes for a game to come out, where, like, the average turnaround time is, like, 3 to 5 years, that there are already X number of live service games in development right now that need those components to land, but they'll be landing in, you know, like, an audience reception in the future that might hate that stuff. So they're all, I mean, Skull and Bones is not going to work.
No.
Like, Suicide Squad's live service stuff, maybe, but I feel like that's another Avengers. I just think it's going to be saved by the gameplay, hopefully. But yeah, I think they're done, personally. I just think that you'll see the dregs of it for a while. It's like a clogged pipe, and it just needs, the rest of it just needs to get out there, and then we'll have whatever the next idea is to try and fleece us going forward. It'll be something else, but I don't think it's live service stuff anymore.
I hope that's true. I don't think they'll ever go away, but I do think, like you said, companies only have so many gambles in them, and Ubisoft are all in right now, because if they get one hit, that could theoretically save them. But if they get no hits, then they're kind of done for, and they have to pivot entirely. Like, is Assassin's Creed Infinity going to work? I have no idea. It's a strange move. Will The Last of Us Factions work? I think that's got a better chance of working, but that's also because Sony, as of yet, hasn't pivoted themselves to be entirely about live service. They're still bolstered by those regular single-player games, whereas Ubisoft is pretty much in a raft in the middle of the sea going, I'm going to put all of my hopes in the live service raft-building enterprise. I don't know where I'm going with this, and hopefully I'll get to some civilization.
I feel like if they just, I mean, Jules said this on one of the pods a couple of weeks ago, it's like if they just led with something smaller and just genuinely do right by people first, you get people who actually just want to say, we want to give you money. Like people say that to Hello Games nearly every time they tweet. Like, can we give you more money because we've already bought the game and you're giving us all this DLC? Like, if they nail that initial component, then you have an active community. And maybe you stay away from the term live service. Like, at some point, that's just quite a toxic term. You probably could have something that was more genuinely received, had a nice little community behind it who play it all day long, and who would like to put money into some skin packs or whatever it is. And it's more of an actual relationship between the community and the devs.
See, I like that in a sort of utopian view. I just think from the point of view of these companies, they are kind of like all or nothing. They want all of the money, you know what I mean? Mm. And you see something that comes out that's really great and that should be an easy win that fails, like Marvel's Midnight Suns.
Or the Avengers?
I was thinking more something that people like, though. Okay. You know what I mean? Something like Marvel Midnight Suns comes out, gets great reviews, people love it, like there's a diehard fan base there. But then a few weeks later, it's revealed that it's a financial disappointment. And for someone like Ubisoft, I imagine they're looking at something like that thinking, what's the point? Yeah, it might win people over in the short term, but they, in their mind, they need those billion-dollar franchises. They need those mega brands. So why even bother doing that if you can make a great game and people still won't care?
The thing is, like, the Ubisoft thing, I feel like they've proven that doing the biggest bet possible has backfired. Like, there's like 12 live service games that have like been shuttered in the last couple of months. And like I said, I don't think there's something like Skull and Bones is going to prove that model works again. In Midnight Suns' case, it's like interesting because everyone assumed it was going to be a live service and everyone assumed that you were going to be able to buy card packs and have all these microtransactions, and there's not any of that in the game. Well, there are, you can buy a premium currency to buy certain costumes, so there is that, but you get the vast, vast majority as part of the unit price as buying in. That game's also phenomenal. I absolutely love Midnight Suns. And I feel like there probably is a pocket of people in there who absolutely love that game who would put some money towards a recurrent spending model. It's just that idea of launching with it, or when you advertise your game, the marketing coming across as having live service elements like card packs or whatever. Those are the things I think that would, if you get on top of that, your messaging is better. It doesn't feel like you're fleecing people up front. I still like the paradigm changing being the thing that it's the upfront that needs to change. It's the assumption of being fleeced that needs to be ironed out.
Yeah.
And just being more humble with what you're releasing and not going, here's this massive multi-deal, multiple-year thing, and then it just isn't sustainable.
Well, this is it as well. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I am just picking these off the top of my head, but when was the last time a live service game released that got the same reviews as something like an Elden Ring? You know, it was getting 9 out of 10s, 10 out of 10s, even high 8 out of 10s. You look at something like
Apex,
yeah, which is a success, right?
Yeah.
But you look at something like Back 4 Blood, which got like, you know,
like sixes.
Sixes, lukewarm reviews. Mm. The original Destiny, lukewarm reviews. The Avengers, lukewarm reviews. All of these lukewarm games coming out. Mm. There's nothing in the live service space, again, off the top of my head, that has that punch that lands with a, you need to play this. It always comes with a lukewarm response and promises that it might get better. Mm. Nothing in that space so far has, you know, really announced itself as something that I'm going to feel like I'm missing out not playing.
It's a weird thing because I feel like the industry saw the likes of Steam Greenlight, where you could pay to get in on a game's development early, and then when, and that's just over time has mutated into this whole, like, okay, what's the barest functional version of a game that we can just get out the door and get people playing and get people spending money on, finalize the storefronts. How many different games have we seen have finalized storefronts where the storefront is immaculate but the actual game doesn't run very well? Just get that out the door, and some sort of like weird business meeting is attempting to say, you know, oh, we'll build the community over time. Just get them on board, just make it work. And I feel like that's the stuff again that has backfired, because you're leading with so much stuff that is taking advantage of people's good faith in your product or in your company or whatever. I mean, does the industry ever get more humble again at this scale?
Nah.
I don't think overall. I think bigger sections of it will be forced to become more humble. But yeah, I I don't know, man. I just think that the live service thing has proven to lose so much money. And even if you're a cold, hard, stat-crunching person, you just look at the risk, and it ultimately is your capital that's on the line. So I think they'll think of something else. But what the hell that's going to be, I have no idea.
No.
Because they're still obsessed with growth. It still is a capitalistic medium, for the most part, and so obviously in terms of the business stuff. A question from Willie Arroyo, who says, what are our thoughts on the whole Death Valley threat of Activision's Bobby Kotick to the UK Competition and Markets Authority? Also, what Switch's Game Boy / Advance game did you play first? I immediately played Wario Land 3. That's a hell of a show. I loved that game as a kid. The Game Boy stuff, what are your Game Boy thoughts?
I have a lot of nostalgia for the Game Boy, especially the Game Boy Advance, but when you mentioned, Scott, that the Game Boy stuff was coming to the Nintendo Switch online the other night, I got really excited, then looked at the games, realized I'd played none, and then didn't get excited, which sucks. It's kind of like I finally understand how you felt when you saw the PS1 lineup on PlayStation Plus.
Well,
to an extent.
You
just thought, this is underwhelming. Yes. This isn't necessarily as good as it could be. I'm sure there are great games on those libraries.
Calling Minish Cap underwhelming,
I never said Minish Cap in particular.
Okay.
People say that's really good. You've been telling me it's the most underrated Zelda.
So good.
I just mean, from a purely personal perspective,
yes,
I wanted to see some like proper naff games on there.
I bounced off the walls when they said Game Boy and Game Boy. I couldn't believe they did Game Boy and Game Boy Advance, just in terms of game libraries, because I do love the idea of just having a handheld legacy system. And the more they've plugged into that over time, where now you have NES, SNES, N64, Game Boy and Game Boy Advance, all just in the palm of your hand. Like, that's just a beautiful sentence that I absolutely love it. And for me, the first thing I played was which was my first ever Mario, the one on the Game Boy, and I always forget the full name of it. It's like Super Mario Land 2 and the 6 Golden Coins. And that was my first ever Mario game when I was a kid. So I went back to that and then just had a ridiculous amount of nostalgia. You ever have so much nostalgia that you just sit being overwhelmed by it for a bit and you just realize how much of a life you've lived in between the last time you heard that noise or the last time you did a thing? That was me. And then I just went through everything. I mean, I love the Minish Cap. Obviously, you've got that version of Mario Land 3. Or Mario 3. I love that they let you tweak the original Game Boy, Game Boy Pocket, or Game Boy Color rendering style.
Yes.
So it's like, it made me really hearken for Pokemon. I really hope they put the original Pokemons on there, red, blue, and yellow, or green, or whatever. But yeah, so for me, I just freaked out. It was everything, but it was the original Mario, because that's a deep cut.
When they put on the Planet of the Apes game based on Mark Wahlberg movie, and when they put on those knockoff Spyro games and Crash Bandicoot games and Spider-Man Mysterio's Menace, that's when I'll be on board.
Do you know what they mean? They'll never do this because they'll have to do some sort of deal with Disney. But the Game Boy Advance Star Wars Episode 3 game was brilliant. It was like a side-scrolling, like really well-animated, pixely, just action platformer thing. And it's so overlooked because it's nothing like the other console versions. But I love that. But yeah, also shout out to Minish Cap. I think we had a question about Minish Cap somewhere further down. But that is hands down the most overlooked Zelda of all time. And it's such a beautiful art style. It's just a gorgeous game. So I'd recommend that. In terms of the Bobby Kotick stuff, we looked up the quote for this before going in because we vaguely saw some headlines about Bobby Kotick saying the UK would become a Death Valley if the Activision deal didn't go through. He's basically hinging this on the idea that the Activision deal going through is, in his eyes, lining up with the idea of being like a tech forward, a progressive move for tech, for gaming overall. And, you know, if the likes of Cambridge, Oxford, various other universities are also tech focused or progressive places, then this is the best thing. Because if they don't do this deal, then oh my God, the UK fails as some sort of hub of tech or gaming or whatever. It's insanity.
Reading this quote, right, was kind of like when, you know, if you have like a brother or, you know, any kind of siblings and you kind of rinse them, you're like, oh, you're an idiot. I hate you. You're the worst person in the world. And that's fine. But when someone else says it about your brother, you're like, do not say that ever again. Like, you don't get to say that. I get to say that.
Yeah.
When Bobby Kotick was in this court slagging off, you know, the state of the economic system in the UK right now, he's kind of making sense. You know, we are in a situation right now where everything is a travesty.
We could be a lot better.
UK government hates the UK citizens. Mm-hmm. Some more than others, absolute nightmare scape to live here at this moment in time.
Yes,
but it's hilarious sometimes that Bobby Kotick is like, you know what the remedy to this would be? it's some massive monopolistic deal going through because that will save it and turn this Death Valley into Silicon Valley. He's like not wrong with the idea that, you know, we're in dire straits right now, but it's such a manipulative thing, in my opinion,
yes,
to say that, you know, this deal is like the bastion of hope that's going to transform the UK into some kind of European leader, because it's not.
It's not.
Self-serving. It's self-interest. It in coming from a nightmare man like him, it feels very disingenuous.
Yeah, and it's like, and not to like make this into some sort of political podcast, but for me, the problems that come to mind when I think about like governance of the UK are far more relating to human rights or infrastructural rights or various things in regards to train lines functioning or just basic decency when it comes to making sure people are warm during the winter or whatever, things like that. It's I'd love to know what his internal mental flowchart is of like this tech deal, this Call of Duty goes onto Game Pass and somehow that makes my grandma warmer at winter. Like, yeah. I just don't know how the hell that's even remotely comparable.
Yeah, Microsoft owns Call of Duty, therefore the cost of living crisis is actually sound and people can heat their homes and we're not using policy to attack the most already marginalized people in the country. Get off it, Bobby, so I can get off my own soapbox, please.
Robert, we sort of saw the headlines for that across the last few days and then checked in for the full quote this morning. It doesn't make sense. Of course, it comes from someone who's one of the most disconnected billionaires on earth.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe there's more to it over time, but I initially we read that and just went, that's one of the stupidest things that someone of a supposed intelligence could say. Next question from Dan, who says, hope we're both doing well. I mentioned that I'm learning to play guitar, so I wonder if they wonder if I have any tips on someone interested in doing the same. Also, how good was that Nintendo Direct? It was really good, Josh.
I didn't watch it, man.
It was so good, though.
I was trying to think. I don't think I've ever, not because I hate Nintendo, love a lot of Nintendo stuff.
I don't. You can't stand.
I just kind of, I don't have that appeal to them, man. I wish I loved them. I really wish I did.
I wish you loved them.
It's watching people who love Nintendo is such, it fills your heart full of joy because they mark out and they pop so big for like some of the, in some announcements that I just do not understand the significance of, but it's just so nice to see people have such fun with it.
Remember when Kirby could move in 3D?
There you go.
Oh my God.
Like that means nothing to
me.
But I love that people have just like that moment to look forward to seemingly every few months, like the fanfare that arises when a Nintendo Direct is announced is palpable. It's just, I'm on the outside of it. It's like the Mario movie, funnily enough,
or
the Nintendo thing.
The Stained song. You're on the outside. Looking in.
I'm going to just agree with you.
Reference. Linkin Park's out today. But also, I think that you did check into see Tears of the Kingdom's latest gameplay stuff.
I did.
Which kind of looks like they're doing a Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts approach, where it seems like you can make your own vehicles and hovercrafts and whatever. It seems like you're going to be able to get access to a bunch of components and then bolt them onto different structures, which I love the idea of that. I love the idea of, like, if you think about, like, Breath of the Wild's core thing was, like, physics experimentation. So it's like, how do you sort of bolster that and how do you go beyond? I couldn't think what they were going to do with that. And I love the idea of you just take parts of the environment and combine them all together and make some weird makeshift mechs that you can then fly around the environment. That sounds really cool. I don't know if that's definitely a game feature, but that seems like that's what they're showing off.
Yeah.
What did you think of that as the follow-up to Breath of the Wild?
Man, like for 6 years almost, yes. I've been just wanting more Breath of the Wild.
Mm.
And this looks like more Breath of the Wild, but like with fancy new additions. I love the kind of nuts and bolts adjacent stuff that you were mentioning there. Like the introduction of these vehicles that look like so ramshackle and cool. And I love that aesthetic. I like that, you know, obviously you've got Hyrule, but now it seems like obviously we've known this from trailer one more or less that we're going to the sky, but we're also going underground. It feels like the levels are going to hopefully have literal levels to them with a sense of verticality that you had definitely in the original game, but stretching that out even more. I thought it looked lush. I mean,
I love Link's new design.
Yeah. Like the first game was absolutely no slouch and was a real looker, but
true.
The fact that this is on the same hardware, you know, coming so many years later, it does look like it has a visual punch for me. You know, I'm not necessarily massively deep into the Legend of Zelda lore, so the story side will be something that I experience very fresh and without much context, but from a gameplay perspective, from a visual presentation perspective, I was looking at it, and whilst it might not be the most mind-blowing trailer in the world, it got me very excited for it, and I can't wait to see more.
I do quite like how they're playing their cards quite close to their chest. It's almost a double-edged sword, where me and James Dallas were talking about this just afterwards, just saying, like, we both still don't really know what this is. Like, it almost feels like the best expansion of all time or something, because it is is reusing so much of the environment. And then obviously graphically, it's not really a step up. It just looks like more of Breath of the Wild. I kind of thought that, like, as much as I love the sort of pastoral Breath of the Wild look, and it's a little bit cel-shaded kind of thing, with certain effects in the environment, I did think that when he was like up on top of certain rocks looking down at the below, I thought that was derezzed to the point of reminding me of Pokemon Sword and Shield. Pokemon Scarlet and Violet.
Right.
Where I was just like, oh, that looks quite muddy, and obviously it'll fill in over time. But I do love that they show that bit where Link dives off and you get that really, it's almost iconic before it's even out, of like him diving and the camera panning right out and everything. And it just looks really, really cool. Yeah, I'm there for the lore. Like, I hope we get to play Zelda. I'm assuming that we'll get to play as Sheik if Zelda does, because she's falling into something, and I'm assuming she'll come out as Sheik or something. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there about ancient magic systems. You've got Ganon's corpse doing stuff.
Yeah.
There's an evil moon in there, which is a bit like Majora's Mask.
Love that.
Which I was just like, because, you know, Tears of the Kingdom is very much the Majora's Mask to Breath of the Wild's Ocarina of Time. It's a reuse of a lot of those assets and then doing something else with it. And Majora's Mask, obviously, big evil moon, changing the time of day and everything. And I thought that's what the narration was in the trailer, because it showed a big blood moon. And I was like, oh my God, that's one thing they could pull from, that we all just kind of accepted as part of the world in Breath of the Wild. Hey, by the way, the moon resurrects everything. For no real reason, it just does. And I guess they could say, hey, there's actually a really evil entity. And if it turns around, there's a face on it or something.
Yeah.
And it's the Majora's Mask moon. Maybe they do something like that. So yeah, I watched it and I was a bit like, that looks cool, that looks promising, but you're holding so much back that I just can't get that excited about it. And then I pre-ordered the Amiibo and I freaked out about all the potential lore stuff. And I was like, no, I am in. Like, no, you've got me, Nintendo. So yeah, I thought it was solid overall. I just want more. And I know that they want you to wait. And there's obviously the £70 or $70 price tag thing
as well.
Yeah. Which is a shame. I think that, you know, they've said it's going to be case by case basis. They're obviously just seeing what they can get away with. 70 has quite fastly become the new sort of standard price for premium titles, and I guess through Nintendo's eyes, Zelda is as premium as it gets, so they might as well see what they can get away with.
It feels like they've been trying this for years.
Yeah, I'm also not defending it, as I phrased
that. Oh, no, of course not.
I think it sucks.
Yeah, it absolutely does. But it's like, you know, living in, I don't know what it's like in the US or in other territories, but in the UK, those prices stay sky high.
Yeah. On Nintendo too, yeah.
Yeah, and if you're looking at getting, you know, Mario Kart 8 or whatever now, it's still going to be £50 plus, most likely. They're very rarely ever in the sale. So to me, I don't like it, but it's kind of like, of course, we got this premium release. They're going to knock that price up a little bit, especially when the competition is doing that and getting away with it, and especially when they know people will buy Zelda. It reminds me, ages ago, when Activision raised the price of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, for no reason,
right.
It was just by like a fiver or maybe a tenner, again in the UK, and it was just because they could, because they knew people were looking for into it, and they knew they would get away with it with minimal backlash.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With in Zelda's case, it was like Nintendo. Sorry, they said that they've announced like raises for a lot of the key executives, and it's like it's almost exactly because of this price hike. Like it feels like this is because they don't have many other massive AAA, if any other AAA games for the rest of this year. What we class as AAA in regards to the you know, upper echelon of what they're putting out. So it almost feels like this is directly going to them. Like this is their new wage coming from this extra $10 or $20.
Right.
But yeah, even third party stuff that's on the eShop as well as other stores will be more expensive on Nintendo eShop. They've always had Nintendo tax, Nintendo pricing as terms or whatever, and it just always sucks. It's just that it's always Nintendo, and everyone's just like, ah, you scamps, ah, whatever. And it's like, because yeah, you almost can't change it at this point, but it does just suck. Next question from Alpha Oliver, who says, is Nintendo Switch Online worth it for the classic games if I only play single player games? Do I just binge the classic games included from each console and then cancel it if they don't increase the selection, like PlayStation Plus and Game Pass? Hell yeah. If you go into the SNES collection, Super Metroid alone is worth a monthly price point. You've got all Link to the Past if you do N64 stuff. You've got obviously Ocarina of Time. Star Fox is in there. They just added all the stuff on Game Boy, so you've got Minish Cap, like I said. I honestly think there's no comparison. I mean, if I'm talking game libraries, Sony ain't even in the conversation. Game Pass is like close, but Nintendo's god tier. Like, I can't even pretend that that's not remotely true. Nintendo's first party library in one place is there's nothing even close to that.
I have no comment on this, but I'm with this question as well. I just wanted to see your opinion on this, Scott Tilford, because I've also been on the outside,
yes,
wondering whether to take the leap on that extra. Wondering whether to take the leap to get that extra part of the online, because I've always wanted to play those Zelda games, for instance, and there's a lot of other titles on there that I've been interested in, but I've always wondered whether it was worth
it is
paying extra for it. So there all we go.
I'll pay it for you. Do you want some games?
Yeah, please.
Link to the Past?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really do want Link to the Past.
You can get it.
Ocarina of Time.
I do love that they put the original Game Boy catalog on the standard Switch Online pricing. So if you want to play that original Mario, I forget what else is on that original Game Boy thing, but you can't, but original Tetris you can go play. Stuff like that, you get that as part of the regular Switch Online, and the expansion is N64 and Game Boy Advance. Which is a nice little thing. I just think as libraries, like for me, I can't shake on that. I just genuinely believe that. I think that Nintendo's first party is the best stuff we have in gaming, so whatever. Next question from Lord Colacanth, who says, what's a gaming trope that lots of people seem to dislike that we enjoy?
Oh,
they do say, for them, it might be the big, easy spectacle boss at the end of a game. Have your hardest skill check before the finale and then reward me with a flashy, cathartic fight to close out the experience. I massively back that.
I love it when From Software does that in particular. And I know that might be sacrilegious to say because people love like the final tough battles in those games. But I love it when you can just tool on a final From Software boss after defeating the so-called real final boss. That's the real challenge check. And then you're like, nah, let's have a big spectacle fight to finish things out. I love that trope. I fully agree with this.
I'm thinking, because for Elden Ring, you know, I beat Elden Beast first time. I had summoned one person in, but we both like beat that thing first time. And I loved that fight. And that was really fun. I like the thing that Koalakanth says here, where you feel like you've put the time in. And it's almost like in a movie, you would go up against the final character. I love the thing in Breath of the Wild. I'll always remember that again because that final boss is quite easy.
Yeah.
Obviously easier the more time you've put into the open world because it just changes the different phases of the fights and stuff. But I will always remember back in 2017, the first time I went through it, knowing that was the last thing I had to do and then being like, right, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to make a campfire in the game. I'm going to brew all my potions. I'm going to make all my recipes. I'm ready. And then going for that final fight. And obviously the music that kicks in when you go to Hyrule Castle at the end, it's just so gallant and like, you know, it's such a hero's finale. And then you just get to stomp the final boss.
Yes.
And it's like there's two different forms, but it's like for me that was perfection. Like it was absolutely spot on. And like I like if they can, because I don't like that whole thing where something happens and it just wipes you out in one hit, or something happens, it's lots of that stuff in RPGs where it's like, oh, by the way, you were weak to fire and now you're just dead. And it's like, well, I guess I'll do all the cutscenes and do everything again. Like it does take the wind out of the sails a bit sometimes.
Oh man, I'm trying to think of what else I enjoy on that level. I think that they've absolutely nailed it there. For me, I don't even know if people hate this, but I love it when a game pretends it's over and then it is not over and it hits you with a fake credits. Mm. And you know, it's just a waste of time, really, because no one's actually believing that the game is finished.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, every single time, I give it a little wink, give it a little nod, and I think, what a lovely little trope. That, we're back in the action. There's more game to go.
That one in Ragnarok where Thor revives you from your own menu.
Oh, that's so good. Cool. Yeah. So good.
So I was trying to think of other gaming tropes that people seem to dislike that you enjoy. There's not that many, I don't think, in terms of like, I don't know, like are we general plot point stuff, but I can't think of that many that that I gravitate towards.
I'll tell you one, and this wasn't the question, but I just want to talk about it. One that people don't enjoy, and I also don't enjoy. It's like the rule of three thing.
Interesting.
When you need to do something three times and you need to fight against three waves of enemies
before you get to the Nintendo rule.
Yeah. To the next wave. And why I hate this in particular is that for over a decade now, since the original Deadpool game, that's the first time I remember it being called out and metatextually, you know, commented on that. Yeah, right, of course, we're going to do this three times and then we're going to move on. Because once you kind of understand that that's what's happening, you can't unsee it.
Totally.
It's like you're near at the end of the Matrix, being able to see all of the code, literally, in this case. I know I'm going to have to do this three times, and there's no surprise to it. And I just don't know why developers, maybe it's just so good, maybe it works for people who don't know exactly how this thing has been structured, that they'll never change it. But once my eyes were open to that kind of game design pillar, I can never unsee it.
Have you seen, is it Jim Carrey's The Number 26? Is it Number 26?
I think it's The Number 23.
Number 23.
Yeah, yeah.
I think of it that way because the rule of three is a whole wider psychological human thing. There's a weird, I can't pull any specific headlines about this, but I've read about this in the past, that like the number three or three attempts at something or a time span of 3 days or whatever, three applies to us in lots of weird ways in terms of human psychology, where if you're beginning a journey, the first day is the hardest, the middle, well, you're already halfway there, and in the third, you're almost finished. It's like there's always, it's why like trilogies tend to work. There's a whole psychology, human psychology, about why threes work.
Interesting.
And I think that's why it works. I think that someone happened upon that, obviously just in-game design, and there's something satisfying about hitting something three times or whatever. Obviously, I agree with you that it's quite tiring in 2023. But I think it's there because there is that wider sort of attachment to a set of three things for whatever reason.
Feels right.
Yeah, somehow it kind of feels right. Question from PG Quips, who says UBP, UBP, which I didn't do at the start, but the UBP. I'm an Xbox player, more than a PlayStation player, but recently the PlayStation Plus Essential monthly games have been stellar. This month it's Mafia, Definitive Edition, Evil Dead, and Olly Olly World. Is Sony's service starting to rival Game Pass? I still refuse to pay for demos, though. For the trials.
You know what? Fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough.
I will say, especially on like that PlayStation Plus Essential tier, if we're talking purely about those monthly games. I think Sony and PlayStation has been beating games with gold or whatever it was for
months. Oh my god,
now.
I forgot that existed.
Absolutely. I know they focus massively on Game Pass, but I do like the idea that Sony has had these monthly games that have been just hitting it out of the park recently. This month's in particular, man. I love the fact that more people are going to get to play Evil Dead the game. Mafia Definitive Edition is one of the best remakes maybe ever.
Totally.
And Scott Tilford's beloved Olly Olly World is finally getting, you know, introduced to a new audience. I think it's probably the strongest month they've had in ages.
Oh my god.
And they've had some pretty strong months recently.
Yeah, man. The thing is, like, I like vehemently hate the top premium tier. I think it sucks, but I love Essential. I think that's where you want to be. Like, that is a phenomenal value for money. Like, that does rival the thing that we've said for years about Game Pass being the best value for money in gaming. But just because of getting titles like this, Olly Olly World, I'll recommend on the audio alone, even though I do love the way that it plays. That game's soundtrack is like up there. I'll just say it with like a Vice City or a Hotline Miami or whatever. If you like lo-fi and synth stuff, it's perfect. But yeah, in terms of the overall, the way that they're putting stuff out, I guess this tends to get a lot more headlines because it's like it's titles people know of.
Yeah.
Whereas Game Pass's whole thing, or the way that Game Pass is curated, is kind of assuming you will comb over everything and then just saying, like, well, here's an Immortality or here's a Signalis or whatever, and getting people into the smaller stuff. I feel like their directives are a little bit different, which is nice. I feel like they can't necessarily compete in the same place. Otherwise, they would both be, you know, talking to 2K about securing the Mafia Definitive Edition for that month. So they kind of have different approaches.
Yeah, 100%. But I think, yeah, like you're right. Like, there are slightly different approaches to it. I just do like that Sony haven't been skimping on, like, the big hitters.
No.
You know, this month's is great. I remember a few months ago when we got, was it Yakuza 7, Like a Dragon?
Yes.
And we got Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2. You know, like, really great games, Final Fantasy 7 or whatever it has been in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's just, they've hit a nice stride with it, I think, and it makes people not only want to get those monthly games, but then look into the entire library that's on there now and realize that, yeah, a lot of people might have already played these titles, but if you hadn't, if you couldn't afford them, what a great service it is. You know, we're very fortunate enough right now that we can buy games, we get sent a lot of games, so the financial burden isn't there. I keep saying it, man, if I had Game Pass and I had PlayStation Plus in my early days or into my university days, oh, I would have my variety, my diversity when it came to my game tastes would have like been exponentially better than it was than having to figure out that you know, a lot of Japanese games are great in my early 20s. You know what I mean? You have all of that available to you right away, and it's just such a broad spectrum of really excellent titles.
Yeah, man, I look forward to the conversations that people will have who are like teenagers right now. Hopefully they are delving into stuff, just the sheer curiosity of having that library in front of you. It's like you might as well try something, and the conversations that will come from the game critics of 10, 15, 20 years in the future, having grown up with these libraries in front of them, and like you said, like not having to worry about the financial side of it because you do have those things in front of you. I think in terms of PlayStation Plus, I wish they would just conflate premium and extra or just have one. Maybe like if they want to have a base, if they really want to charge you for just playing online, have that, and then have everything else as like just some big game library. Because I feel like they got a bit greedy with like splitting it a little bit too much. And then obviously I've said loads that I think the premium stuff is just crap. So like the essentials tier, I think that's what you would like lean into. And maybe you just put the PS1 games on there and you just go, here's your one monthly fee. And that lets them compete with Game Pass. That lets them sort of take the headlines of like, oh my God, it's what Mafia Definitive Edition, but also it's Tekken 3. And it's like, you've immediately just dominated that afternoon's discourse like on social media or something. As opposed to continue to trying to split them, which I don't think is working very well. To me.
Another no comment on that one.
Yeah. Next question from Jack Jingle, who says, just want to thank you, sorry, me and James Dowse and Josh for introducing them to Video Game Essays. Currently listening to a Final Fantasy X deep dive across 10 different episodes, which also inspired me to replay Final Fantasy VII again on the Switch, which I've played once again for 25 years, which is mad. Well, all the Godspeed reintroducing yourself to Final Fantasy that I always just love, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Which I'll recommend to you.
Yes, one day, Scott Telford. Now that I've got the PlayStation 1 hooked up, I'll definitely do it. And honestly, if there's a good video essay tied to a game, that's like encourages me to play it more than anyone's recommendation. And you know how highly I hold your recommendations in regard. But to have that extra bit of, hate to say it, content to go with it, to get into a nice bubble with, is always excellent. I mean, the reason I played through all of the God of War games was because I saw Noah Caldwell-Gervais did an entire series retrospective, and I literally watched his review of all of those games, which was like 4 hours long, 5 hours long.
Right.
And then I played through all of the games, and then I watched it again with the added context. It's just, the world of video game essays is incredible. And like we said on that podcast a few weeks ago, such a great way if you're feeling in a bit of a gaming rut and you're not inspired to like get inspired because like they say, you know, it's a great way to get that inspiration and to view even games that you might have played to death in a potential new light.
We can shout some out as well. I mean, I love like Super Bunny Hop. I go to Matt McMuscles' Is What Happened thing quite a lot because he just does really good research looking at like certain titles that notably fell on their face, like Sonic 2006 or Dino Crisis 3 or whatever, and just goes and talks to the devs and gets that rounded picture of what happened to those things. And yeah, Noah Caldwell-Gervais, Jordan Anderson, I think is someone else.
Joseph Anderson.
I forget who else I have had recently because I have a lot of people on rotation, but Super Bunny Hop definitely stands out to me. I don't know if you want to shout anyone out in particular.
I love, like I said, Noah Caldwell-Gervais. Jacob Geller, I think, is excellent doing some of the best stuff. And Tim Rogers with Action
Tim Rogers,
Button.
Yes.
So good. Tim Rogers' stuff like literally changed my entire life. if you're a fan of Final Fantasy video essays, watch his Final Fantasy VII Remake review and the translation that he did for the original Final Fantasy VII. Yep. Both excellent, but I recently watched his six-hour-long review of the PS1 game Boku no Yatsumi, I think it's called.
I tap out on that length one in one go, but you love that.
I love that stuff, man, because the way he does them, it's such like a personal thing. If you're going in just wanting an objective game review or anything like that, you're not really going to get it. You're going to get that. Part of it is that, but it's mostly inspired about experience and context and culture and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was watching him do this review of this Japanese game that isn't even translated, that I have no idea. I had never heard about before and will never get the chance to play, like I said, because I don't speak Japanese and I can't read Japanese and it's not translated and it's going to cost a lot of money to import it.
Right.
But I was watching him talk about it, talking about his own experiences living in Japan. You know, getting information about how, you know, integral to Japanese culture the idea of summer is. And then it goes on a really personal journey that as soon as I stopped it, I picked up a pen and started writing myself.
Nice.
You know what I mean? It was one of those really good inspiring moments where not only did it inspire me to want to play more video games, it inspired me to want to make stuff that I'm also passionate about, you know what I mean? And make my own stuff, not in the same style, but, you know, do something personal myself. I think the power of them are really good, really good.
No, I can only back Tim Rogers' stuff. I came onto him.
Very good.
Both good. With the Final Fantasy VII, the series of translation videos, but I also knew him back when he was doing Kotaku stuff. But yeah, massive shout out to all those people overall. Next question from Richard Smith, who says, with Minish Cap finally being available for a wider audience, it it's the most overlooked Zelda. See, I've told you that. That's what I've been saying.
I believe it.
Are there any overlooked games that you hope get a chance going forward? Another one of mine will be Jet Set Radio Future. I guess this is just the idea of adding stuff to monthly libraries. What do you think they should go out their way to, anyone to go out their way to bring back?
Man, well, I've been playing through Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace, so they should definitely bring that back.
I've been playing through Episode Three. That's pretty good.
That's it. A lot of underrated Star Wars movie tie-in games.
Just movie tie-ins in general, yeah.
Yeah, just get more of that licensed stuff, I think. Like I said, I'm sure if you played those Nintendo Game Boy games, you will love the library that they've got, but I have such nostalgia for the crap movie tie-ins like Planet of the Apes, and that's the reason why I loved and popped so much for them getting Toy Story 2 and the PlayStation Plus
collection. Lush.
More stuff like that, I think. Simpsons Road Rage. You know, everyone talks about Simpsons Hit and Run, but give me Simpsons Road Rage. Give me Simpsons Skateboarding.
Simpsons Skateboarding.
Those games ruled.
There was a Game Boy Advance version of Samurai Jack that I absolutely loved. I'm just like, there was a little thing on the Game Boy Advance. It sort of had this perfect nexus of, like, it was obviously after, you know, the death of 2D games for the most part in the mainstream. Obviously, it was after the SNES and the Mega Drive, and then it was like full speed ahead with polygonal stuff. And then when the Game Boy Advance dropped, it was like a return to, like, the color palettes of, like, the SNES and, like, the mid 90s of 2D artwork. And I love, like, everything the Game Boy Advance brought to the table, because it was like the perfected approach to what they were trying to do with all the hardware back on the SNES or the mid 90s, various consoles in the mid 90s. So, like, you got things like a beautifully animated Samurai Jack game, or, like I said, that later on, that Episode 3 game that sort of dropped alongside the movie. There are so many really cool pixel gems in there that, like, maybe we'll never get another lease on life just because they are tied to a certain license, but they just move so well. They're so responsive. They're so immediately satisfying.
I've got another one that I want to throw in as well, because I cannot believe this is still not on backwards compatibility for the Xbox, but John Woo's Stranglehold. I've been wanting to replay that game for years at this point, and it's annoyingly, I don't have an original, I don't have an Xbox 360, that I can just plug in and play it. So please, Phil, do me a favor and
Mr.
put that
Spencer
on backwards compatibility, or even better, make a remake or a sequel.
Oh, the thing, I remember something about that, because it ties into Hard Boiled, and it was Chow Yun-Fat and everything. So I remember some vague article is coming to the forefront of my mind about how they couldn't do anymore, and it was tied to some licensing deal, maybe some song that was in there or something. Next question from Schmans Schmilliamson, who says, what feature gets you to replay games the most? I figured out mine is time, as in the Resident Evil 2 remake. It's my first ever platinum. I was sucked in trying to go quicker and quicker, replaying the Dead Space remake, but it's not doing it for me like the first play did.
Ooh, that's really interesting. The time mechanic, funnily enough, was something that I used to hate. Right. I hated that Dead Rising was built around, like, a time limit.
Oh, like actual timers,
You know what I mean? Or even, like you said, the more informal trophy chasing time limits, where it's not, like, enforced in a gameplay perspective, but you know it's there and you're trying to hit a certain threshold. But yeah, like, I used to hate time stuff.
Same.
And now I'm way more open to it. Now I love Dead Rising and Destruction.
Play Neon White, Josh.
Maybe one day.
You'll love it.
But, like, the Dead Rising thing makes you replay the game, because you unless you've got, like, a walkthrough, or you're the best gamer in the world, you're not going to see all the events in that game, because, you know, you'll be exploring, you'll be taking damage, you'll be doing one quest over another quest, and you will inherently fail some of the cases that you get in Dead Rising because you don't have enough time. And when they run out, as long as it's not a main mission, you know, the game just keeps going. Mm-hmm. So it encourages you to replay the game, try to maximize your time, and do it that way. So I will shout out briefly that whole mechanic, because I think they implemented it really well. In that franchise kind of lost a little bit of its identity when it did move away from it, and then you realize how much of an integral part of its, you know, clockwork-like structure that actually was.
Mine's is like, when I took the question to be like replaying entire games is what I thought they meant. But yeah, like time mechanics, obviously, if there's something like, oh, you just need to shave off a few seconds. I mean, in Demon Slayer, I'm doing all the optional challenges in that, which is just get higher grades for certain fights. And it's like, but for me, honestly, it's always just going to come down to gameplay. Like the last game that I absolutely loved playing and just wanted to rinse was Sifu. Because I just love the combat system in that. And it was like one of those feelings where, like, when you finish a game, you hit credits, and you just know that you're a better player by the end of that. You've got those systems in you, and it's like, I need to make the most of this while I can. Also, I'm loving, like, the feel of it or something. Because I tried restarting Elden Ring as soon as I finished it, and going all the way back to a new character. I know you can't do New Game Plus, but I was like, oh, I'll just do a new build thing. It was too much. It was just like, oh, I'm losing too much here. Whereas in Sifu, you can just go back to that first level and just absolutely wipe everybody out, because you're perfect with the parries and all the different moves and everything. So for me, it's always gameplay. Just do I need more of this? Have I sort of exhausted it? And something like Demon Slayer, like that entire story mode and the arcade versus stuff, has taken me beautifully into the multiplayer, where now I can kind of hang with the people who are in the multiplayer space as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting
something like that.
Yeah, I like that.
It depends. For me, like how gameplay forward a game is. Are you playing for the story? Are you just trying to see something through? Like, yeah. I'm not going to be going back through God of War Ragnarok, for example.
Yes,
that thing was like one and done in the best way possible. I don't necessarily want to go through that again.
For me, it is more like the love of something that it does well that I just need more of, whether that is the story or whether it's mechanics. I've never really been a guy for New Game Plus modes. Even when I replay games that I've finished, I'll normally just play them again because I like the idea of the progression, unless I'm going for like a really hard difficulty.
Depends what you get on the New Game Plus, I guess. As I mentioned Ragnarok as well, me and you both did everything in that game, like the Muspelheim Trials and like that whole crater section. Like that was like a nice excuse to go mop everything else up.
Yeah, 100%. Like those games are so big that you all almost feel like you're the fill of them when you finish them, and there's a story pull there. Mm. But sometimes when I'm looking at replaying games like Ragnarok, and I have an inability to, you know, ignore things even if I've done them once. So I know if I play Ragnarok again, I'll put another 50 hours in and do it 100% yet again.
Death Stranding.
And it's kind of, yeah, totally. And it's like weighing up, is the story worth that? Because mechanically, it wouldn't be worth going through again for me right now. Mm. But something like Death Stranding, that was mechanically so satisfying that going through that a second time made it feel like a different game, because once you've mastered those systems, you approach that title in such a different way from a like a veteran perspective, because you've been there, you've done it, you've got now an understanding of the most efficient route through the game, that it's satisfying to kind of do it as a pro rather than someone learning it for the first time.
That's true.
That's what I would agree what you were saying about, like, you know, Sifu or Dark Souls or Sekiro or anything like that, where the first time through you're kind of learning and the second time through you're mastering.
Yes.
I like that. The distinction.
I like the feeling as well of going back to areas that you were once like, you know, they were once quite hard, and then you, for whatever reason, you've just gotten so much better that you can just cakewalk through those places. There is a real satisfaction to that. Like you said, it's like mastering the game, the environment, or whatever. For me, it's like the more cinematic the game, the more sort of belabored the cutscene direction or the pacing. It's like rewatching a TV series straight away, and it depends what it is, but like I'm hardly ever going to do that. Like it's designed in a way to be taken in like one time. Like it's always a bigger deal, I find, for the average person to sit down and rewatch like a Game of Thrones or something with like weightier, more mature kind of pacing to it. I just think it depends, but like some games, especially Sony stuff, for me, they're not that appealing as replays. I know like you went back through Last of Us 2 a few times, but it's just Last of Us 1 as well. Like I've played through Last of Us 1 a good handful, but I never went back through all of Last of Us 2. I did all of Ellie's stuff again.
Yeah.
And then I got to Abby and I was like, oh God, I just don't care. Like I'm only doing this to just try and do it all again. But I did a couple of hours of Abby and I was like, nah, I can't do all this again.
Interesting, because The Last of Us 1 is my most replayed game ever.
That's insane.
Played through that thing, you know, maybe not that high of a frequency compared to some other people, but I've played that, you know, 10, 11, 12 times at this point over the years in various forms, you know, the remaster, the remake that came out. Mm-hmm. And that is a story pull. Like the gameplay is great, of course, but I'm there because I want to re-experience that story because I think the story's so good.
I do love just being with Ellie and Joel.
Yeah.
Like, I do just love being around them, watching them, doing their thing.
And for me, it is like rewatching a TV show because it feels like bite-sized. It's like 12 to 15 hours, probably quicker if you know what you're doing, which at that point you definitely do. Mm. And while I've played The Last of Us Part 2 three times and enjoyed them every single time, that game is less inviting to replay, not because I think it's worse. If you know me, you know I like that actually better than the first game, but because it's got that bigness to it. It's got that like length to it in a similar way to God of War Ragnarok, where it feels like more of a project to kind of like sink your teeth into, whereas Last of Us 1 is weighty, but it's also got that brisk pace. It's like, it's very, for me, welcoming to return to.
No, totally. I think it's like, for me, it's just like, what is the time investment? Like, if it was some big, like, 8 to 10 minute song and it goes on a whole journey and it's like a big emotional, someone's like retching their guts out about a certain topic or whatever, I'm probably not just going to go, I'll have that again, like, three more times. Like, it's rare. I'll sort of save that, whereas I would replay something a bit shorter. So, yeah, I think it just depends. But for me, it's always just going to be gameplay. Like, is something moreish and addictive enough? And have I exhausted the systems? And do I genuinely just feel like I want more of it when I hit credits? And are there systems systems that let you go back. Like Hi-Fi Rush, when you hit the credits on that, you unlock a whole endgame thing where it unlocks like customization and all these different goals that you can go into and do in the levels. And if you want more of that gameplay, they're like asking you to go, and they give you goals, like go unlock these clothing components and everything. So I think that's like, that's an intelligent way to do it. Although personally, I would have preferred the character creator way back at the start.
Yeah.
Just to sort of like have the different looks to Chai as the game rolled out.
I think the only time I've gone back and completed a game on one of those, you know, alternate modes that you get after beating it the first time was Max Payne 3 with the New York Minute.
What a show.
Which is really good because I just wanted to play that game over and over again. I think I would have played it about 5 times regardless of that. But that's the only time I recall, you know, seeing one of those modes and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Because for as much as I love The Last of Us Part 1 and Part 2, you know, they have a bunch of different filters or gameplay modifiers that you can add on if you want to replay it, and I love that they're there, but that stuff necessarily isn't for me. If I'm replaying a game, it's for that core experience, story.
That and the stuff that the modifiers that Naughty Dog put in their games. I love slow motion. I think I've said that in some chatty or something at some point, some video. In Uncharted, because they let you pick encounters. I think Last of Us 2 lets you pick encounters, and then Part 1 lets you do it. I love just going into those games, going into super slow motion, and just having slow motion fights with all the slow motion audio, mainly because you can drink in the animation fidelity. And I love just seeing just how well put together everything is. And it's like, oh, so like that, all those blades of grass move when that person goes over here and whatever. And I just love stuff in slow-mo.
I think there are games where you feel full when you beat them, and there are games that leave you wanting more. And one isn't necessarily better than the other.
No.
But for me, again, Uncharted 4, like you were saying, was one that left me wanted more to the point where I went through it again and then was just replaying those combat encounters because there's so many different ways you can approach them, depending on the difficulty, depending on modifiers like slow-mo or whatever, that it was just fun to kind of play a bite-sized version of these really polished mechanics and just see, just like kind of omit the story and see what you can do in it from a gameplay perspective.
I feel like as well, you know, Uncharted 4 or Uncharted in general can sometimes get in its own way in regards to how good the combat is. Like I feel like Uncharted 1, it was like chasing cover systems and it was just like a boring, quite a standard boring approach to a cover thing. And then 2, 3, and 4 have like, what if a platformer had gun mechanics and had combat and you can go around people and jump over and get the drop on them and stuff. And like, once you start thinking like that, it was like, oh my God, this opens it up so much. But they're not like combat focused games. You'd like, it's almost like a third of the whole thing. So especially in Uncharted 4, I would finish encounters and be like, I just want to do that again. So I'd pause and restart checkpoints just so I could do that again.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can only really enjoy the combat or mainline the combat after you finish it and you pick those levels over and over again. So it's like, again, it's all gameplay. It's all gameplay systems and like feedback and whatever. But yes, this has been the Entitled Banner podcast. I was going to keep going until I realized that we've done over an hour, Josh Brown.
Do one more. Go on.
Do one more, he said, as an actor said to a bishop. And do one more from Tom, who says Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts was underappreciated and a great game in retrospect. It was cool seeing the devs take such a risk and trying something new. And Jules' newest tweet made me want to play it again. His tweet, Jules' tweet, was in reference to Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, and the weird ramshackle things that are in that game. That I think we talked about. Did we talk about that before we started recording?
No, we did before we started recording. I was going to say, is there something in the air? Because in the office yesterday, you were talking to me how great of an idea this was in that game, though obviously the game itself wasn't really well received at the time.
No, Nuts and Bolts was like hated at the time because it's like a platformer, but it's mostly about customizing vehicles. I thought it was a cool idea, but at the time I wasn't a Banjo fan because I didn't have my N64, and I just saw people just hating on it. But yeah, as soon as I saw that little weird vehicle car thing in the Tears of the Kingdom trailer, I was like, that's so Nuts and Bolts. That's so literally thrown together to get you somewhere. And then me and Jules, like, he messaged me on the next morning. He was like, are they doing a Nuts and Bolts? Are they influenced by Nuts and Bolts? So I feel like a lot of people are just using that as the comparison point because there's not that many games that let you just throw stuff together in a mainstream sense. They got that big. So yeah, Tom just says, you know, is this, am I mad for thinking this? Or are these the kind of risks that we want to see devs take? Yeah, massively. I feel like it makes total sense in Tears of the Kingdom's case because it just is an expansion of all the you know, experimental physics-y stuff that you had before. But yeah, I miss physics in games.
Yeah.
I miss, like, I was playing Immortals Fenyx Rising a couple of years ago, and a lot of that game's puzzles are just sort of like punch through this wall to get something behind it or swing something all the way around a level so at the right length so it hits something. And I just like the idea of playing with physics. I feel like we got away from that because so many devs, Kojima talked about when he was making Metal Gear Solid 2, that they don't want to just use Havok physics. They want to have specific like canned animations or specific motion captured animation. And that that gets away from Ragdoll. And you get stuff in between where, like, Rockstar have the Rage Engine, or there was that Euphoria engine for Force Unleashed, where it's ragdolling to a point, and then maybe an arm will, one of the MP, like a Stormtrooper's arm will grab a corner of something to try and latch on, but the rest of the body's flailing around. And it's like, I like that. I like the idea of playing with that. But I just miss physics. I want to be able to chuck stuff around more.
Playing, you know, the one redeeming part for me of the Callisto Protocol's gameplay was that you could pick up the monsters wholesale and just launch them at a wall. And when you upgrade that ability, they just explode when they hit a surface, which is excellent.
They just explode.
And it's also the beauty, like you were saying, I mean, I love physics in games, especially when you can use them in creative ways, but it's why Breath of the Wild was so enjoyable to me. Even the shrines, I love that all of the shrines, you know, they have a way that they're supposed to be completed, but you don't have to follow that.
No.
If you can manage to jerry-rig, you know, a solution to these puzzles, the game will let you because it's all working on the same logic. And even if it's not the most honorable way, perhaps, to get through some of those puzzles, it feels like you've almost cheated the system. And it's a rare joy in video games to feel like you've cheated the system with how scripted everything has to be in order for you to not just break everything.
I love
it. It always is satisfying.
I love that feeling in Breath of the Wild where they sort of do tell you to do this near the start, where there's a whole, like, there's a camp of, like, bokoblins, like, down a hill, and you've just got the bomb thing. So it's like, well, I can just roll this down the hill into them and then detonate it from afar. But then once you start thinking like that, it's just ways of chaining all those different things together, or setting some trees on fire, which make them freak out, which make them run into another explosive or whatever. And it's just like, yeah, like, the way that Breath of the Wild makes you think, like you said, you've been waiting so long for just more of that game. That thought process is just so seldom, especially these days, where it's just sort of, how do we make sure that every single player gets the specific experience and making it more on rails? Whereas, like, I will take a million more Breath of the Wilds or a million more Immortals Fenyx Risings over the game design ethos that underpins an Uncharted, where it's like, run over here and shoot this one guy and then go over here and, oh my God, you missed a step and you've got to do the whole thing again. Like, I wish physics stuff came back. We grew up in the golden age of Havoc physics and, like, everything across the 2000s, and I remember, like, Hitman, you would shoot a dude and they go flying, and they still kind of do some of that now, but not as much.
Maybe because I'm a complete freak, like I said, but I used to play the level of, I think it was Hitman Blood Money, where it was a sort of suburban environment where it was like a party going on. I used to go in there with those two pistols and just kill everyone, which is not the point of a Hitman game, but the ragdoll physics was so ridiculously over the top that you would hit people with these two pistols, and it was like you were playing out a Quentin Tarantino movie, like it was Django Unchained.
Yeah.
People were getting shot once and going flying.
Flying over the horizon.
So satisfying in and of itself.
I will take that stuff, literally. Like I said, hopefully more physics going forward. I kind of thought that more studios would take that stuff on board after Breath of the Wild, but I feel like because it's Zelda, it's almost so untouchable. And that's why I always champion Immortals Fenyx Rising, because although it is literally Ubisoft going, okay, what worked? Let's do that. They do it way better than most. And that game's DLC falls apart, but the main game is really solid.
I think that's a good point, though, and not to keep going on, and we'll wrap this podcast right now.
Lovely Friday.
I think the reason we don't have more of it is just because it's hard to do. Zelda gets it so right, but there have been great games that I've played, like Metal Gear Solid 5 or Dishonored or a lot of arcane games, to be honest, where you do have that freedom, but the game isn't quite, for my money, as good at encouraging you to experiment, because in Metal Gear Solid 5, for all of the tools I had at my disposal, I knew the most efficient way to get through encounters because a lot of the encounters were similar, so I was just relying on the same few gadgets over and over again.
True.
And that is, yes, definitely a me problem, but I didn't have that with Zelda because of maybe the level design or the encounter design. Or maybe it was a more robust understanding of the tools at my disposal, but I always felt like I was experimenting in that game.
Yeah.
And I do think that is something to be said about, like, the developers and their, you know, ability to implement those mechanics.
It's a little bit like what Far Cry used to have. Like, Far Cry 2 is like, set a fire over here and all the NPCs will run away from it or whatever. And just like ways of sort of setting up ambushes, like in Far Cry Instinct, where you could sort of go on the ground and then look up on you get on your back and you could shoot up through cabins to shoot dudes who are above you. There's ways of, like, figuring it out yourself. Even if the devs always knew what possibility you would do, at least you felt like you were exploring a space. I guess we'll see how experimental Tears of the Kingdom is and whether it literally is not the nuts and bolts spiritual sequel, because there's so few games that do that. For now, though, this has been the Untitled Banter Podcast, the UBP, the UBP.
UBP.
Yes, joined by Josh Brown and myself. I don't know, this isn't the usual ending. Usually I say something like that, and then Jules says, come find us over on Twitter, because I'm at /LP89. Jules is at RetroJ with a zero. You are Josh Brune 00.
Yeah.
To feedback on whatever thoughts you have on any of the madness that we've said this week.
Thank you for having me.
A massive thank you to you for diving in. And we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.